Good morning. This meeting will come to order. This is a public meeting of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission to consider final rules under the Dodd-Frank Act. I'd like to welcome members of the public, market participants, and members of the media, as well as those listening on the phone and watching this webcast. Today is the 27th open meeting of the Dodd-Frank rules. We will consider a final rule on designated contract market core principles. I'd like to thank Commissioners Summers, Chilton, O'Malley, and Wiegand for their significant contributions to the rule writing process and CFTC's hardworking and dedicated staff. I'm going to read my statement of support since there's just one rule here today, but I support the final rulemaking on designated contract markets, which includes rules, guidance, and acceptable practices. It advances important Dodd-Frank Act transparency reforms. The Act squarely addressed the historically opaque swap markets through its strong transparency provisions. A critical element to this is pre-trade transparency, requiring standardized swaps between financial firms, but just those that are cleared and made available, and those that are not blocks, to be traded on exchanges such as designated contract markets, swap execution facilities, and on recently finished rules regarding foreign boards of trade. When markets are open and transparent, prices are more competitive, markets are more efficient and liquid, and costs are lowered for the companies and their customers. Now, designated contract markets have long demonstrated the value of open and competitive trading, and these exchanges, for the first time, will be able to list and trade swaps, helping to bring the benefits of pre-trade transparency that designated contract markets have had for decades to the swaps marketplace. In addition, the Dodd-Frank Act incorporated the previously existing 8 statutory designation criteria for designated contract markets into what's called core principles. So it took designation criteria and folded it into core principles and expanded that list, adding 5 new core principles. So the final rulemaking from the commission we'll consider today conforms to these various transparency reforms. I think it benefits from extensive public comment, provides exchanges, rules, as well as guidance and acceptable practice to comply with the new Dodd-Frank core principles. Many instances, we're codifying industry practices that the commission has observed and found works within the marketplace. While preserving a principles-based regime, these regulations will provide greater legal certainty and transparency to the exchanges themselves in determining their compliance obligations, as well as to market participants in determining their obligations, and will facilitate from time to time when necessary enforcement of such provisions. The final rulemaking is consistent with the core principles-based regime in the Commodities and Exchange Act, and I think that the rule provides each exchange or designated contract market with the flexibility to employ additional measures to address core principle requirements. It's just one example. The final rule requires DCMs to put in place effective pre-trade risk filters, including pauses and/or trading halts to address extraordinary price movements that may result in distorted prices or trigger market disruptions, an important provision, particularly in today's increasingly electronic marketplace, a world with high-frequency traders and algorithmic traders. But the rulemaking also recognizes that pauses and halts comprise only one category of risk controls and provides that additional controls may be necessary and be put in place by exchanges to reduce potential for market disruptions. So the final guidance, as opposed to rule, but the final guidance includes, for instance, that exchanges may possibly implement price collars or bands, maximum order size limits, or message throttles. So it gives a sense of the flexibility that's built into the guidance. Today's rule does not yet finalize Commission's proposal relating to Core Principle 9, which some in the public have called the 85% provision, which requires designated contract markets to provide an open, competitive, and efficient market mechanism for transactions that protects the price discovery process on the central marketplace. I expect the Commission to consider a final rule in this matter when it takes up the CEF rulemaking later this summer, or I should say, I hope sometime this summer. The additional time, I believe, will allow the Commission to more fully analyze the many public comments on these provisions, including comments on the implications for exchange of futures for swaps transactions, so-called EFS transactions. And I know I'm a little bit into the esoteric here, but I think it's important that we have some time to consider the relation of these transactions to the transparency reforms of Dodd-Frank, as well as the requirement for non-discriminatory access to clearing. And I'm glad that we've arrived at a place where we can take up Core Principle 9 when we later take up the CEF rules. Before turning to my fellow commissioners, I'd like to address a few other items the commission has been considering and will take up in the near term. I usually get asked this question at the end, so I thought I'd just address it up front. We recently completed the joint rule with the Securities and Exchange Commission to further define the term swap dealer. We are turning shortly to the rule to further define the term swap and securities-based swap. The staff at the CFTC has made very good progress in putting forth to the commission a final rule for our consideration. I would say working jointly with the SEC staff, and my compliments to them as well. In an effort to leverage these resources and complete the rulemaking, I'm pleased that we've also arranged for a staff member from the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs to supplement the excellent work of the CFTC staff with technical assistance, particularly with respect to consideration of costs and benefits. In consideration of costs and benefits of financial reform, I believe the Commission should take into account the overall benefits to the American public and market participants of increased transparency, lower risk, and help protect against another such crisis that occurred in 2008. I don't know if anyone needs to be reminded, but 8 million Americans lost their jobs as a result of that crisis. I believe Commissioner Chilton spoke well and made a similar point on this in a speech he had earlier this week. The Commission also approved this morning a proposed exemptive order regarding the effective dates of certain Dodd-Frank provisions. It had originally been calendared for consideration at today's meeting, but we decided just to move it along. I have a longer statement of support for the record, but most importantly, the proposed exemptive order provides additional relief through December 31st of this year. This is the third one of these that we've moved along. Furthermore, it addresses comments from market participants requesting clarity regarding the transactions in and clearing of agricultural swaps. We look forward to public comments on that, but I think we've addressed that concern well, as well as comments from unregistered trading facilities that offer swaps for trading. In addition, the Commission will soon complete a final rule establishing data record-keeping and reporting requirements for pre-enactment and transition swaps, collectively called historical swaps. We'll do this through what's called Part 46. This rule will promote transparency by helping to give regulators a fuller picture of the swaps market from prior to when we completed the Part 45 rules for data reporting. I also anticipate that we'll be seeking public comments in the near term on an exemptive order regarding certain contracts traded on regional transmission organizations, as well as an interpretive guidance on the cross-border application of the swaps provisions of Dodd-Frank. And with that, I think I will recognize Commissioner Summers.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the whole team for all of your hard work and diligence in getting this final rule before us today. It's very much appreciated. Core principles were designed to allow DCMs the flexibility to establish compliance regimes that fit with their markets and business models. This flexible approach has been very successful. The proposed DCM core principle rules published in late 2010 significantly and needlessly strayed from the flexible approach in favor of a prescriptive, one-size-fits-all, rules-based approach. I did not and still do not support abandoning the flexible, principles-based approach to regulation. I am pleased that in the final rules before us today, we recognize the value of retaining flexibility and have pulled back from the overly prescriptive regime set out in the proposed rules. I understand that in a number of areas where we have established specific rules, we have codified the best practices already in place at DCMs today. While on the face, this may seem reasonable, but I have lingering concerns about whether codifying today's best practices will prevent exchanges from developing tomorrow's best practices. Our industry evolves quickly, and we are on the cusp of regulating vast markets and diverse products that we have never regulated before. We must remain vigilant to ensure that our lack of experience in these markets and with these products does not cause us to stand in the way of continued evolution and progress. Conspicuously absent from the rules we vote on today are final rules relating to the Core Principle 9, execution of transactions. The proposal requiring at least 85% of all trading in each contract to occur in the centralized market or risk force delisting was an unnecessary solution in search of a problem. Moreover, in my view, it was at odds with the Commodity Exchange Act, and if challenged, likely would not withstand judicial scrutiny. An unfortunate result of these proposed rules has been that exchanges, particularly smaller and newer exchanges, have been reluctant to list, and in some cases have decided not to list new contracts because of the uncertainty surrounding the possibility of forced delisting if liquidity did not grow within the specific time frame set by the government. When we take up final rules relating to Core Principle 9 in the near future, we must seek to establish certainty so DCMs can get on with listing new products without fear of forced delisting, and we should reject any construct that fails to recognize that the Commodity Exchange Act does not require every listed contract to serve a price discovery function by trading in the centralized market. Another core principle that is of particular concern to me is Core Principle 21 relating to financial resources. Nobody can argue against the notion that DCMs must be financially secure and must have sufficient resources available to continue their operation. The challenge becomes balancing the need for DCMs to set aside capital for regulatory purposes with the need for DCMs to deploy their capital to build robust, competitive businesses that create jobs and additional opportunities for market participants and American businesses. The rules we are voting on today allow for sufficient flexibility to appropriately achieve that balance. Flexibility, however, when not carefully and appropriately exercised, can upset that balance. We need to make sure that does not happen. Finally, last month we finalized the further definition of swap dealer, major swap participant, and eligible contract participant. And rumor has it, and the chairman has just confirmed, that we're getting close to finalizing the product definitions. Once that happens, there will be a date certain for entities to register as swap dealers or major swap participants. It appears that the date certain for required registration will be well before the Commission issues final rules or guidance related to the extraterritorial application of Dodd-Frank and before the Commission issues final rules on capital and margin. As we sit here today, I have yet to see a term sheet, a comment summary, or a working draft of the extraterritoriality release. And I have not seen any drafts of final rules for margin and capital. I have no reason to believe that either will be final before registration is required. Requiring registration before critical rules are finalized makes no sense and is contrary to the approach being taken by the SEC. It is my understanding that the SEC does not plan to require registration until after all of their substantive rules are finalized. This gives market participants the ability to fully evaluate what activity triggers the registration requirement and all the costs and benefits associated with registration before this decision to register must be made. This is a reasonable approach and one I would hope we would consider. As I have said many times before, this process is complex and these rules have consequences for market participants. We are all aware of the importance of making this new regulatory framework for derivatives successful. With every step forward, we must try to avoid taking an unnecessary step backwards. But we seem to have a penchant for putting the cart before the horse. I strongly support a concise, clear, and comprehensive implementation plan that can harmonize the efficacy of these rules with both domestic and global regulators. I'm concerned that as we get closer to the finish line, we may look back only to realize that no one is capable of crossing it. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Summers. Why don't we go to Commissioner Amaya?
Thank you. Today, the Commission will consider a final rule on core principles for designated contract markets. I'd like to thank the team for their hard work. It's a large rule, and there's a lot of moving pieces. You've been done a great job to help keep us informed and to walk us through all the pieces, so I greatly appreciate that and to adopt many of our changes. Before I get into my statement, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned the joint memo with OIRA, which is the Office of Intergovernmental Regulatory Affairs, and I greatly appreciate this new level of cooperation that you have engaged. I think that OIRA and OMB are the keepers of the gold standard for cost-benefit analysis, and to bring them in to our process, albeit late, but is going to be a great step, and it's going to make our rules better and able to withstand legal challenge. I wholeheartedly support it, and I greatly appreciate this cooperation between OMB and this agency.
I thank you for that, Scott. I mean, I think it's helpful to get the technical assistance. I think we have excellent staff here, but particularly as we started to look at this product role and trying to get it across the line, we made this arrangement. I thank everybody because we did enter into this memorandum of understanding that we're still an independent regulatory agency and we're, you know, trying to get some technical assistance from their great staff.
Independent or not, they have kind of the collective wisdom on cost-benefit analysis and, you know, whether we are going to, by letter or by memo, adhere to it. That it's a great step. I'm not going to bite the hand that feeds me on this one and be able to support this. Let me go back to the core principles for the DCM. When the Commission proposed the original proposal in December 2010, I expressed some serious concerns regarding the overall prescriptive approach to this rule. I believe the Commission core principle regime for DCMs has worked well and has provided important price discovery and hedging functions and has adapted to the market as we've seen it. I think the clear port issue that Commissioner Summers has referred to and the chairman responded to regarding EFS was an important adaption at a time post-Enron that allowed for more companies to bring to clearing some important products, mitigating fellow customer risk. Congress left the core principles largely intact, recognizing that the futures market has weathered the financial crisis far better than other markets. And I'm pleased the Commission is going to adopt a rule that has scaled back many of the prescriptive rules that were originally proposed. And at the proposal stage, and since that time, I've expressed serious concerns regarding Core Principle 9, which, as proposed, required 85% centralized market trading requirement. Under the 85% test, the DCM would be forced to delist any futures or swaps contract that failed to meet that trading volume of 85% in a centralized market over a 12-month period. Not surprising, this rule is highly controversial and was widely opposed. I am able to support the rule today because the Commission has decided to delay that decision and have a comprehensive discussion on the execution alongside of the Commission's CEF rules, core principles, and hopefully we'll have some better insight as to what mandatory trading requirements we'll have. So there are three goals I hope that we can accomplish in doing this temporary delay of Core Principle 9. One is to consider available alternatives to the 85% test. Two is to anticipate and calculate the associated costs and benefits of Core Principle 9 to the overall swap trading infrastructure. And three is address the related implications of the rules for transactions executed on CEFs and for off-exchange transactions, including blocks and exchange for derivatives positions. To this end, I hope the Commission will hold a roundtable on the execution of futures and swaps platform rules and the mandatory trading requirement in order to develop a more complete understanding of how the execution rules will impact both the futures and swaps markets. I'd also like to note that the Commission has made changes to the rules and guidance under Core Principle 21, which will enable the Commission to consider alternative financial packages. And if the Commission hopes to create competition in this space, we must be flexible and cannot expect all DCMs to meet a core principle that is a one-size-fits-all approach. Additionally, I'd like to mention the Core Principle 4, which I think gives DCMs greater flexibility regarding the monitoring of for market anomalies. I also appreciate the recognition that the staff included in the preamble regarding the Technology Advisory Committee and our efforts to understand pre-trade functionality and high-frequency trading. And I do appreciate that they did not front-run us on this one and are going to let the process work. As the chairman noted, it's not presented here because the commission signed it, took action to further modify the temporary exemptive relief. This action would propose, among other things, to extend the temporary relief from July 16th of this year to December 31st. Based on the chairman's statements at a recent industry conference, the commission will complete Dodd-Frank rules by the end of the year. Assuming this to be true, I think the proposed amendment is appropriate and will provide the industry with the necessary comfort, and the new swaps regulatory regime will not disrupt current market practices. The big question in my mind, however, remains, which rules are we talking about, and what is the order that we will consider them? Notwithstanding the proposed amendment on exemptive relief, I believe the market continues to seek guidance regarding the timing of the remaining rules. I see no reason why we shouldn't make the process completely transparent and outline all the remaining rules and the proposed schedule for their consideration. For that reason, I've included, along with my concurrence on that seriatim vote, a list of what I believe are the remaining commission rules, orders, and guidance, as well as a timetable of when I understand the commission expects to vote on these rules, orders, and guidance based on conversations I've had with staff. Now, this is a draft. I've color-coded it by foundational rules, clearing and trading rules, et cetera, and I will put it on my website. I'll include it as part of my concurrence, and I'll make it available to anybody that wants to take a look at it. But it looks to be about 30 more rules we have yet to do. Not all of them are Dodd-Frank. There's a OCR rule, for example. There's a couple other things in here, but I think that these are all things that the commission is going to consider over the next couple of months or over the next 6 months as we try to meet this year-end deadline. So my hope is to put this in with the exemptive relief to get some input on it, to see what the market thinks of the proposal, to give comment on which rules should go first. I did this about a year ago. We're in kind of the last 6 months of this rulemaking, so I want to make sure that we, as we go in, we pick our priorities and we figure out what it's going to take to get us across the line to complete all of our rules within the appropriate deadlines and the schedule the chairman has set. So that'll be available on my website. We'll put it as part of the Federal Register as well. I'd like to thank Nadia and her team again and everybody on the team for their hard work and patience to accommodate many of our requests. So thank you very much for that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Malley. Commissioner Chilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sometimes I think this process is a little bit like, a Rorschach, that it just looks different to different people. And I think, actually, we've done a really remarkable job. We've had 62% of the Dodd-Frank rules. There's 300 Dodd-Frank rules out there in the government, and, we've got a little more than 50. But 67% have not been done. 67% of the 300 have not been done. But we're well over half. I mean, we've produced, 32? Is that 32 today? So, the process doesn't always go along swimmingly, absolutely. I mean, I'd agree. But we've got a lot of rules. We've got more work than this agency has ever had. And, you do the best you can in life, right? That's what you do. And, all of us get frustrated at times. But I really want to thank the chairman because the staff, you're a taskmaster and you've been out there whipping them and they've taken it. And once in a while we hear screams up on the ninth floor. But by and large, you've kept it under control and you've done a very good job and you've kept the trains moving on time. And when you look at all of the other agencies, all of the other agencies are working on Dodd-Frank, nobody comes close to doing what we've accomplished. They don't hold a candle to it. I mean, I won't mention it by name, but there's one agency that they've only met one time this year. And they got a lot more rules than we do. So I just want to say we produced a lot. The chairman's produced a lot. The commission's produced a lot. Staff's produced a lot. And I thank you for one. Now, on cost-benefit, just a brief thing. I appreciate the dialogue we've had in the past and appreciate what Commissioner O'Malley has said. And we all want to get to a good cost-benefit analysis. And I think this OIRA thing, this MOU, will be helpful. But, you know, it is in no way any commentary on our any past or current litigation. I mean, these things are a dime a dozen, these MOUs. I'm not making light of the importance. It's important that we have it. I look forward to the technical expertise. If we can get a full-time equivalent staff person here to help us, since we're underfunded, then that's so much the better. If you ask people in the countryside, well, why do you have to do these memorandums of understanding, these MOUs? I mean, shouldn't you guys just work together? I understand that perspective, but, you know, we've got to protect confidential information. We want to guard against disclosure. So you have to do these documents to protect markets, protect businesses. And so we're always trying to do things better, get more advice. And in that regard, I want to, again, thank the chairman for another thing, and that's being responsive to other ideas, not only Commissioner O'Malley's, but the thought that, I had yesterday and spoke about looking at what are the costs of not doing these regulations. Not just the profit and loss statements on a balance sheet, which is important, but, you know, what are the costs if we didn't have oversight of the hundreds of trillions of dollars in swaps? Could we be back where we were or where we still are trying to crawl out of? So I thank the chairman for being responsive on that, for continuing to be open to ideas and trying to incorporate them as best you can as you see fit. We've produced a lot. So I guess my parting thing would be, let's keep the hammer down. Let's keep going. There was a vegetable farmer who, when I was working on a farm bill one time, he urging me to get it done, he said, let us produce. Get it? Let us produce. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Chilton, for all those comments. Commissioner Wiegand.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank the staff, too, for all your hard work on this rule. Appreciate your flexibility in the last couple of weeks, accommodating a lot of the changes that I've requested. The final rules before us today codify and interpret the core principles that apply to designated contract markets, or DCMs. As with so many of our rules, today's recommendations are designed to protect the public and ensure fair competition between exchanges and markets. The recommendations seek to accomplish this objective in multiple ways. They require, for example, risk controls and safeguards for trading on regulated exchanges, which better ensure that our markets remain transparent and stable. They also require that DCMs, as self-regulatory organizations, are capable of detecting and preventing position limit violations, disruptive practices, and manipulation. Additionally, the rules protect the efficiency of our markets, both by ensuring the integrity of listed contracts and by ensuring that participants have appropriate clearing arrangements, thereby mitigating counterparty credit concerns that could impede liquidity. And the rules set forth a number of additional requirements that will enable DCMs to transition from trading venues solely for futures contracts to venues facilitating trading and swaps as well. As we consider these rules, it is important to acknowledge that the Commodity Exchange Act's principles-based regulatory regime was retained in Dodd-Frank. Indeed, Congress not only retained much of the previous DCM regime, but also expanded that regime to new registered entities, like swap data repositories and swap execution facilities, or SEFs. But it is equally important to acknowledge that Dodd-Frank did not merely restate the existing regulatory responsibilities of DCMs. It expanded those responsibilities by authorizing DCMs to facilitate trading in swaps and to facilitate such trading between retail market participants. These swap-related functions and responsibilities in the evolution of the futures markets over the past decade informed Congress's decision to add several new core principles to the DCM regime, as well as provide the Commission the authority to specify the means of compliance. It is important, however, that the Commission use this authority cautiously and avoid unnecessarily upsetting the expectations of those who depend on the exchanges. To be sure, private incentives are not always aligned with the public interest, but in seeking to align those incentives, we must take care to avoid doing harm to what is now a functional and effective marketplace. In light of these considerations, the swap market structure poses difficult policy questions for the Commission and equally difficult operational questions for DCMs. The rules before us today will not answer all of these questions. Perhaps most consequentially, the Commission today is not considering Core Principle 9, so that it can fully evaluate it in the context of the swap execution rules. Many DCMs and potential SEFs no doubt would like regulatory certainty on this matter, but I am confident that the public will be best served by a continued dialogue on Core Principle 9 and related issues. Public input remains our best protection against unintended consequences. The debate about Core Principle 9 is not and should not be about a particular trading venue or business model, nor is it about the value of trading through the centralized market. Centralized trading enhances the transparency and efficiency of markets, and centralized trading generally means increased pre-trade transparency and, more specifically, order book transparency, which provides important information about the supply of and demand for a particular commodity or contract. In short, centralized trading facilitates price discovery, provided there is sufficient trading interest to discover. I believe there is consensus on the objectives of increasing centralized trading and pre-trade transparency. There remain, however, many challenging questions about the best means for achieving these objectives. For instance, there can be tension between our centralized trading objective and our statutory objectives of reducing systemic risk and promoting responsible innovation at exchanges. I look forward to engaging with the public on these questions in the months ahead. For now, I am confident that these final rules appropriately carry out the relatively modest changes to the core principles regime for DCMs. The other commissioners mentioned our completion of the proposal on the exemptive order, and I obviously supported that, and I look forward to the comments on that. Commissioner Summers and I were talking ahead of time. I think one area of particular concern that I'm going to be interested in reviewing comments about is whether it's better to have a sunset date, as we've done the last couple of times now, or whether we consider some other approach. So I look forward to the comments on that. Thanks again to all the professional staff and the DCM rule team. Appreciate all your hard work on this and look forward to continuing our discussion on Core Principle 9 and other matters. Thanks.
Thank you to all the commissioners. With that, I think I'll turn it over to the staff. But if I would note, I think on the sunset date, which is important, I guess it went back to when Mike Dunn first suggested it a year ago, it has allowed us, it wasn't anticipated a year ago that we would do a third one, but it has allowed us to refresh it and, for instance, now address ourselves specifically to, I think, were important comments that came from the agricultural community, from packers and merchants and farmers that said we needed to address something. So we hadn't focused on something like that a year ago, and I'm glad we're able to address that. And that's just one example, but, you know, it may well be that come November, if we need, hopefully we don't need another one, but if we do need another one, there'll be some new issues that will, you know, have emerged that we need to incorporate. So I think it's a balancing. It was Commissioner Dunn's suggestion, but I think it's allowed us to refresh this and bring it, particularly this agriculture issue, I know was an important one. So we're going to have Rachel Berdansky, Rick Schiltz, Nancy Markowitz, Nadia Zakir, David Van Wagner, all from the Division of Market Oversight, and Mike Penick from the Office of Chief Economist, present to us.
Thank you, Chairman and Commissioners. I'd
Could
like
you
to
move
thank
the mic a little closer?
Sure. Is this better? Thank you, Chairman and Commissioners. I'd like to thank our DCM rulemaking team, and in particular Nancy Markowitz, Aaron Brodsky, and each of the persons at this table, as well as all of the hardworking and dedicated staff of the Commission for helping with this particular rulemaking. This final rulemaking establishes the regulatory obligations that each DCM must meet in order to comply with Section 5 of the CEA. Commodity Exchange Act, as amended by the Dodd-Frank Act, initially upon designation and thereafter on an ongoing basis. Section 735 of the Dodd-Frank Act amended Section 5 of the Commodity Exchange Act pertaining to the designation and operation of contract markets by first eliminating the 8 designation criteria, then amending most of the core principles, including incorporating most of the substantive elements of the former designation criteria, and finally by adding 5 new core principles. In addition, Section 723A3 of the Dodd-Frank Act added Section 2H8 to require, among other things, that swaps that are required to be cleared must be executed either on a DCM or on a swap execution facility or SEF, unless no DCM or SEF makes the swap available to trade. On December 22, 2010, the Commission published proposed regulations to implement the statutory provisions of the Dodd-Frank Act relevant to the designation and operation of DCMs under Part 38 of the Commission's regulations. The Commission received numerous written comments from members of the public, and Commission staff participated in several meetings with market participants, including representatives of both currently designated and prospective contract markets. In this notice of final rulemaking, staff is requesting that the Commission adopt many of the proposed rules, guidance, and acceptable practices. However, as a result of the written comments received and dialogue with market participants, the substance of a number of the proposed regulations have been revised, and in several instances, the proposed rules are replaced with more flexible guidance and/or acceptable practices. By way of background, the Commission has regulated designated contract markets since the enactment of the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000. Through its oversight of these markets over the past 10-plus years, Commission staff has gained a substantial understanding of the practices that DCMs have adopted in complying with the various core principles. In implementing the relevant provisions of the Dodd-Frank Act, staff first undertook a comprehensive evaluation of its pre-existing regulations, guidance, and acceptable practices to determine whether any core principles would benefit from new or revised guidance or acceptable practices, and which core principles would be better served by the codification of rules. In some instances, this final rule is converting proposed rules to guidance and/or acceptable practices, largely based on specific comments that address the need for greater flexibility. In other instances, the final rulemaking is maintaining the proposed rules with appropriate revisions arising from the Commission's staff's consideration of comments. These rules largely implement new statutory mandates or codify certain requirements and practices that have evolved, are commonly accepted in the industry, and that staff has found, based on experience in overseeing DCMs, to represent the appropriate means of complying with the core principle. Many of the final rules also reflect conclusions and determinations contained in the rule enforcement reviews that staff periodically carry out to examine a DCM's compliance with specific core principles. Commission staff believes that the codification of clear-cut rules that reflect the statutory mandate and existing practices will provide greater transparency and regulatory certainty to DCMs in determining their compliance obligations and to market participants in determining their obligations as DCM members. These rules will also improve the ability of the Commission to enforce its regulations. These final rules, guidance, and acceptable practices implement and clarify the obligations of DCMs with respect to the core principles, while at the same time preserving the principle-based regulatory framework under the Commodity Exchange Act. In the interest of time, I will provide a general overview of selected aspects of the final rulemaking and will look forward to responding to any questions on specific aspects of the rulemaking. As an initial matter, the final rulemaking includes additional regulations and revisions to the existing regulations in Part 38 pertaining to the process of applying for designation as a contract market and to certain other designation-related requirements. The final rulemaking provides a comprehensive application form for contract market applicants, along with a specified list of documents and information that must accompany the application in order to provide additional transparency and efficiency to the designation procedures.
The rulemaking also eliminates the accelerated approval procedures for DCM applications, requiring instead that all applications be reviewed under the 180-day statutory review period and procedures. The final rulemaking also adopts rules governing the dual registration of a Board of Trade as both a DCM and a swap execution facility. In particular, a Board of Trade that is designated as a contract market also may operate as SEF, provided that it separately registers pursuant to the SEF registration requirements and on an ongoing basis complies with the SEF rules and core principles under Section 5H of the Commodity Exchange Act. Moreover, any Board of Trade intending to operate a DCM and a SEF may use the same electronic trade execution system for listing and executing swaps, provided that they make it clear to market participants whether the electronic trading of such swap is taking place on the SEF or the DCM platform. For the 23 core principles, I will briefly highlight some of the key proposals. Several core principles require a DCM to establish and enforce compliance with the rules of the DCM. Amended Core Principle 2, for example, requires a DCM to establish, monitor, and enforce rules relating to access requirements, terms and conditions of contracts to be traded on its system, and rules prohibiting abusive trading practices. The core principle also requires the DCM to have the ability to detect rule violations and sanction persons that violate the rules. The implementing regulations for Core Principle 2 in this final rulemaking are derived from a number of sources which include specific statutory mandates, current standard industry practices and existing guidance and acceptable practices, and practices stemming from rule enforcement reviews and staff experience in regulating DCMs. For example, the proposed regulations would require DCMs to prohibit a list of abusive trade practices, all of which are already prohibited by most DCMs today, and others prohibited by statute or under commission regulations. In many instances, the regulations codify existing practices, including those requiring automated trade surveillance system, real-time market monitoring, and regulations pertaining to investigations and investigation reports. The final rules also include a requirement that DCMs must obtain from their members and market participants consent to the DCM's jurisdiction prior to granting access to its markets. Staff believes this is an essential precondition to a DCM's ability to carry out its statutory obligations under the core principles. Core Principle 6 also imposes compliance obligations on DCMs with respect to emergency actions. Under the core principle, a DCM is required to have rules to provide for the exercise of emergency intervention in the market. Recognizing that DCMs may have different procedures for taking emergency action, staff believes it is appropriate to maintain an expanded version of the guidance of the existing guidance that includes provisions emphasizing cross-market coordination of emergency action and to have alternate lines of communication and approval procedures in order to be able to address in real time emergencies that may arise. Staff believes that this is an important obligation in light of the need for DCMs to be able to react quickly to market events and to intervene without delay. Over the years, DCMs have developed certain standard practices for emergency programs, which are included in this final rulemaking as acceptable practices. In the notice of proposed rulemaking, the Commission proposed regulations implementing amended Core Principle 9, which requires, among other things, that DCMs provide a competitive, open, and efficient marketing mechanism for executing transactions that protects the price discovery process of trading in the centralized market. The proposed regulations included, among other things, a rule requiring that 85% of the total trading volume in any contract listed on the DCM must consist of centralized market trading. The rule included a mandatory delisting requirement for non-compliant contracts, specified procedures for treatment of pre-existing contracts, and provided a limited exemption for certain contracts upon petition to the Commission. The proposed rule also included guidance and rules pertaining to requirements for block trades in futures contracts and other off-exchange transactions, including exchange of derivatives for related positions. The Commission received a significant number of comments on many aspects of the proposed rules under Core Principle 9, including comments pertaining to the Commission's interpretation of the core principle as proposed. Staff has considered these comments and believes that additional time is appropriate before finalizing the proposed rules for Core Principle 9. In particular, staff recommends that the Commission take up the proposed rules under Core Principle 9 when the Commission considers the final SEF rulemaking. The additional time will allow the Commission to consider the available alternatives for contracts that may not comply with the proposed centralized market trading requirement, as well as any related implications of the rules pertaining to off-exchange transactions, including exchange of derivatives for related position transactions. Another group of core principles pertain to the requirements for contracts traded on a DCM and the DCM's obligation to monitor trading activities. Core Principle 3, for example, requires that contracts listed on a DCM must not be readily subject to manipulation. The final rule maintains the existing guidance for Core Principle 3, with necessary revisions to provide greater detail to DCMs regarding relevant considerations when listing a contract, including swap contracts. Amended Core Principle 5 requires DCMs to adopt for each contract, as is necessary and appropriate, position limitations or position accountability, and requires that this limit cannot be higher than the position limit established by the Commission for any contract. The implementing rule for this core principle requires that each DCM comply with the requirements of Part 150 or 151 of the Commission's regulations as applicable. Core Principle 4, now titled Prevention of Market Manipulation, was amended to require DCMs to take an active role not only in monitoring trading activities within their markets, but also in preventing market disruptions. The implementing rules include a requirement that DCMs have the ability to conduct real-time trade monitoring and comprehensive trade reconstruction. In order to prevent market disruptions due to sudden volatile price movements, the rules also require DCMs to establish and enforce trade risk controls, including but not limited to market restrictions that pause or halt trading in the event of extraordinary price movements that may result in distorted prices or trigger market disruptions. In response to comments received on this topic, the final rulemaking includes acceptable practices that provide a non-exhaustive list of additional risk controls that DCMs may implement to further reduce the potential of market disruptions. The rules also require DCMs to require all traders on their markets to keep specific trading records that are available to the DCM to enable it to carry out its obligations under this core principle. Core Principles 11 and 21 pertain to the financial integrity of markets and the financial resource obligations of DCMs, respectively. Amended Core Principle 11 requires DCMs to establish and enforce rules and procedures for ensuring the financial integrity of transactions entered into on or through the DCM, including the clearing and settlement of the transactions with the DCM. This core principle also requires DCMs to establish and enforce rules to ensure the financial integrity of any FCM, Futures Commission Merchant FCM, and introducing broker. In particular, the rules require DCMs to adopt rules establishing minimum financial standards for both member FCMs and introducing brokers and non-intermediated participants, and to conduct ongoing financial surveillance of the risk created by FCM customer positions on DCMs. Under the final rules, DCMs must have rules prescribing minimum capital requirements for member FCMs and IB and intermediated brokers, and to the extent that a DCM allows customers direct access to its contract market, they must implement certain direct access controls and procedures in order to provide member FCMs with tools to manage their financial risk. The FCM would continue to have primary responsibility for overall risk management, but the DCM would be required to establish an automated risk management system permitting an FCM to set appropriate risk limits for each customer with direct access to the contract market. New Core Principle 21 requires that a DCM must have adequate financial resources to discharge its responsibilities and to maintain financial resources sufficient to cover operating costs for a period of at least 1 year, calculated on a rolling basis. To implement this core principle, the final rulemaking includes regulation addressing the types of financial resources available to DCMs to satisfy the financial requirements, valuation and calculation requirements, and financial resource reporting requirements. Finally, new Core Principle 20 establishes operational and system safeguard requirements for all DCMs. The rules implementing this core principle require that DCMs establish and maintain a program of risk analysis and oversight to identify and minimize sources of operational risks, emergency backup procedures, and a disaster recovery plan, including resources sufficient to enable resumption of trading and of all responsibilities and obligations during the next business day following any disruption of its operation. The rules also require DCMs to notify Commission staff of various system security-related events, including providing relevant documents, and to conduct regular, periodic, and objective testing and review of its automated systems. The Commission also received a number of comments pertaining to the costs and or benefits of certain proposed regulations. Staff has undertaken an extensive review of the costs and benefits of the regulations being adopted in this release and has determined that the final rules appropriately balance the costs and benefits associated with the oversight of DCMs pursuant to the Commodity Exchange Act as amended by the Dodd-Frank Act. I would be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you, Nadia. With that, I'll consider a motion on accepting the staff recommendation on the rules, guidance, and acceptable practices for DCMs.
So moved.
Second.
Nadia and team, I'm going to do something a little unusual, but Commissioner O'Malley and I both have some questions around Core Principle 3, and particularly Core Principle 3 for the public is about contract markets ensuring that their contracts are not susceptible to manipulation. I'm saying it in lay terms, but I think we're both interested, and I'm going to let Commissioner Malley take the lead, on how this relates to price reporting agencies. For instance, many of the contracts relate to, in the energy markets, to things from Platts, or in the financial markets to things from something from the British Bankers Association called LIBOR, and so it's very relevant. So Commissioner Malley is going to ask some questions, but we both might have some questions here on this.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
He's taking part of my time.
Appendix C guidance to Core Principle 3, as Chairman noted, provides that where private sector price reporting agency calculates settlement prices, DCM should, quote, should verify that the third party utilizes business practices that minimize the opportunity or incentive to manipulate the cash market price series, end quote. This core principle is not new, and neither are the use of PRAs. How has DCMs complied with Core Principle 3, and do you expect the compliance obligations to change with respect to the use of the PRA settlement prices under this new rule?
Yes, Commissioner. As you've noted, Core Principle 3 has been around for a long time. It is not new, and PRAs are not new either. I think generally the way the exchanges, the DCMs, have looked at, well, first let me say there's nothing in the DCM final rulemaking that addresses PRAs specifically. It really is talking about exchanges using, for cash settled contracts, setting prices based on some third party, which could be another exchange, you know, like a lookalike, or it could be a price reporting agency, but the same principles would apply. But I think in general, when many of the exchanges have looked to listing contracts based on indexes or whatever that the industry have generally used either for settings, in many cases for swap contracts or based on those. And I think to a large extent they've relied on the reputation and industry acceptance of a particular index, whether it be a Platts price or a British Bankers Association price or whatever. And I think to a large extent our staff have generally kind of looked to the reputation of these entities as to some extent ensuring compliance with Core Principle 3, that this is something the industry has accepted, that everybody, there hadn't been necessarily issues raised with the methods or the procedures used by these price reporting agencies. I think of late, and I know you've been very interested in this, there's been both when the industry, in general, and then the DMO staff has taken a closer look at some of these price reporting agencies or the indexes that they're using for settling various contracts, whether it be in the energy space or financial contracts, and looking at going back to the exchanges and taking a closer look because of some issues that have been raised about the ability to get precise information about how the PRAs are actually computing their prices and how robust the prices are, and whether there are potential or there would be potential for entities that have positions in swaps or futures markets to distort those prices. So to some extent, the additional guidance that you referred to was an attempt to have the exchanges do, I guess, a more robust due diligence review of these, the prices that they're selecting, the PRA prices that they're being used for settling cash-settled futures, well, and then ultimately swaps, and that they, in addition, make sure that not only that to do a better evaluation of what they're using, but also that they in effect do have the rights to that. In some cases we found that they didn't, and that there's an ability to get information to look to the extent possible from the price reporting agency so that they and then ultimately our staff or surveillance staff can assess whether those that are contributing to the price reporting have positions in futures or ultimately in swaps as we get that data for doing oversight to make sure that those that have an incentive to distort the PRA price, that we can take action against them if they're doing that to benefit on a position in the futures markets. So we don't have, as I said, there aren't specific rules or guidance that goes directly to PRAs, but this is an ongoing. As I said, you've shown a strong interest in this. This is an issue that we are exploring in a number of contexts, and I know IOSCO has a project going on to look at this. So ultimately, it may lead to further guidance or rules or just inform how the staff looks at these contracts that are submitted.
I think all five of us are interested, but Commissioner O'Malley and I decided to sort of share this line of questions. I take it from what you say that under Core Principle 3, that you do believe that contract markets have had and will continue to have some obligations to ensure that if they're relying on an index, whether it's an oil index or a financial index, that is not readily susceptible to manipulation.
Yes, that is correct. And then the additional language in the guidance was kind of to flesh that out, things that we felt the exchanges should look at when they're making their assessments and making a determination about a particular price reporting index to use for settlement.
I mean, in essence, if the underlying index is susceptible to manipulation, then it calls into question the contract itself.
Yeah, it calls into question its compliance with the core principle, yes.
I'm sorry, Commissioner. Well, as I said earlier, I support the rule, and so I had lots of questions for you over the last 18 months, but I think that this really finds the right balance. I think it's benefited from public comment, including rules, but also acceptable guidance and practices. It, as Commissioner Summers says, it dials back on the rules and puts more into guidance. And I use the one example on risk mitigation or pre-trade risk filters. I think it will benefit the markets by giving greater clarity to exchanges and contract markets moving forward. Commissioner Summers.
Thank you. I have just a couple of different questions. First of all, with regard to Core Principle 2 and under the access requirements, there's a provision that requires DCMs to obtain in writing from market participants the consent to the DCM's jurisdiction. And I just wanted to talk through how we would expect the DCMs to accomplish this and how flexible we will be with their approaches.
I'll take that question. I mean, it's staff's expectations. We actually purposely in the rule didn't, you know, state how an exchange would, you know, has to go about this. We think it's important that an exchange has the flexibility for itself to figure out how it's going to work to go ahead and obtain jurisdiction. There will be various ways that I can envision they could do this. Some exchanges, those that don't have any intermediation, they'll have the names, addresses of their market participants to directly contact them and to secure those agreements. Other exchanges with intermediation, it could be a mix of they will have names, addresses of some market participants, even those that aren't members, because some of those people are registered at the exchange for fee programs. They'll also utilize the services, I would imagine, of their clearing firms to secure those agreements. But they will have the flexibility to determine for themselves how to do this.
Can you talk a little bit about what this accomplishes for us? And without this type of consent from market participants, what our concerns would be?
Our concern in this area, let me just start with saying that we thought it was important to cut. Basically, we think this rule codifies the requirements in Core Principle 2 that a DCM have the capacity to detect and investigate and impose sanctions for rule violations. In the past, something that we have found in conducting our rule enforcement review examinations is that there have been several instances where an exchange has seen a potential violation and they refer it over to the commission. And the commission will take a look and enforcement determines and they can bring an action. But when the Division of Enforcement brings an action, they will bring it for, you know, violation of commission regulations or the statute. They don't bring actions typically for violations of the exchange rules. We think it's important to establish and for exchanges to do it up front that all market participants understand their obligation to comply, you know, to comply with exchange rules, participate in investigations, and to participate in the disciplinary process. So that would be what is behind these rules.
So this is nothing really new. We've always thought that these market participants had this obligation, but this just puts it in writing.
This puts it in writing, and there have been instances where the DCMs haven't believed that they have had the jurisdiction. And we think clearly now with this language in Core Principle 2 in this rule that it sets forth our expectation that they exercise this jurisdiction.
Thank you. Then I have a couple of questions about Core Principle 21 and the preamble language, and I think Nadia talked a little bit about this in her opening with the flexibility that we would provide to a DCM in calculating their operating expenses, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how that would work.
I will take that question. I think we contemplate a continuation of what we've done in the past year or so, or a couple of years, in connection with similar financial resource requirements that are in designation orders for DCMs, I think, in the last 3 years. And we've approached this in a practical manner on a case-by-case basis. And I think we will continue to do this, being mindful of the two goals that you mentioned, which is to secure, you know, have financial security of DCMs. On the other hand, recognizing the capital requirements of the DCM. And what, the way we've approached this is the flexibility in costs, and we've had some internal guidance that we've applied, tried to apply consistently, but also with some flexibility depending on the particular situation of the DCM. And, for example, we've, in terms of costs, we've approached relatively new or, let's say, DCMs that have had that have not had as much financial resources. We've been viewed costs to not include such things as non-cash costs like depreciation or amortization. Also, we've basically looked at costs as those costs that are needed to continue to be in compliant with the core principles. So we've excluded things like growth costs. And so in that way, many DCMs, in particular new DCMs, have been able to meet the cost requirements to meet the financial requirements. So I think we contemplate continuing to do that, being consistent as we can, but on the other hand, providing flexibility on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. With regard to those entities that may have multiple registrations and share costs, how do we do those type of evaluations, and how do we ensure that there's no double counting?
Sure. Regulation 38.1101 under the final rule provides that an entity that is registered, for example, as both a derivative clearing organization and a designated contract market has to comply with the financial resource requirements of both of those entities under our regulations. However, what it would have to do is it would demonstrate that it has sufficient resource to operate the single combined entity. And so staff anticipates that a corporate entity that operates both more than one registered entity would be able to share certain costs. And to give you a specific example of that, if you have, you know, a corporate entity that operates both a DCO and a DCM, and they have an employee that that works for both, I would say, we don't contemplate that we would require that corporate entity to count that full salary of that employee both for the DCO and then again for the DCM, but rather would be able to share that cost.
Okay. I really appreciate this type of flexible approach, and I think it's important because I think we will have a number of new registrants that are in much different positions than our typical situations in the past. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Before I go to Commissioner Chilton, I just remember just one. I believe it's Core Principle 11, but I'm just highlighting it a little bit for the public, but confirming this, Nadia and Nancy, that we did finalize in this, or we're about to finalize in this, what we propose that parties who have direct access to exchanges have to have a futures commission merchant, somebody checking that they actually are guaranteed before the trade sent to the clearinghouse. Is that correct? Do I have this? Yeah.
The direct market access provision pertaining to the IOSCAR principles of 6 and 7. I think that's what you're referring to, Chairman.
Wait, I can't.
Is it the rule that's designed to ensure that the clearing members of guarantee trades have a means to risk manage and the trades of customers who enter their trades directly?
That's correct. We do have a rule that would finally.
Well, in essence, it's consistent with that which we did about a month ago when we finished rules for futures commission merchants also and finalized some rules that they have pre-trade risk filters to ensure that somebody's standing behind the trade before it goes to the clearinghouse.
Correct.
And we have that. We have sort of the – this marries up with that rule to help promote anonymous trading on contract markets. I thought it was part of Core Principle 11, Financial Integrity of Transactions, when you gave the shout-out to the Tech Advisory Committee. What's that, Scott? Core Principle 11.
Chairman, I would just say that we put the obligation on the DCM that direct market access provision requires that the DCM be able to facilitate the FCM's risk controls, their management of risk, to the extent that there is a direct market access participant that bypasses the FCM's own controls.
I see. So it's the DCM has to facilitate the FCM doing their job.
That's correct.
But it marries up so that when swaps or futures come to a contract market, somebody's guaranteeing it in the clearinghouse.
I believe so, correct.
Thanks.
I want to thank the team. I think you did a very good job. I don't have any questions, although we've asked them in our briefings, but, you know, like all of these rules, you know, may need to do some interpretive guidance, and this is an effort to make a more perfect regulation. We may not be exactly perfect, but we'll have to do some guidance probably as we have had on others. You know, like I said earlier, doing the best we can, and particularly when we're talking about a market that we heretofore hadn't regulated and is so large. I did want to make one point because I saw this mischaracterized in the media recently about core principles. By and large, the core principles have added a whole lot of flexibility to what the exchanges can do. And if you look at the volume in the futures industry between 2000 and 2005, there was a five-fold increase in volume in the U.S. compared to a three-fold increase in futures other places around the world. So, you know, maybe that had something to do with the with core principles. Things like exchanges offering products, offering a contract. You know, I was told that it could have taken in the past 5-6 months to approve something, and now they can self-certify. We have the ability to, you know, question it, and it's a whole list of things we can do, but it allows them to be more nimble and to be more quick, and I think that's been good. But the point I wanted to make is that just because we have core principles and we're expanding them into the OTC land, that doesn't mean that under the Commodity Exchange Act that we don't have the law behind us with regard to not only oversight but enforcement. I mean, we can still very aggressively, in fact, more aggressively, because I think the core principles enhance our ability to go after violations of the Commodity Exchange Act. So these aren't separate things. It's not core principles versus the law. The law overreaches all of it. The core principles enhance our ability to oversee and enforce markets, I think it also enhances the flexibility of the exchanges. So I just wanted to sort of correct that because I read it someplace that it was core principles were just loosey-goosey, and, you know, nobody went under in the financial collapse. No firm went under because of their position in the regulated futures world. It was, you know, OTC land that was a problem. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Chilton. Commissioner Malia for take two.
Thank you. To kind of start this one, I do appreciate the Commission taking kind of the unorthodox step of removing a core principle and considering it later in order to understand better how this transaction space is going to work. And I think that's a great a great solution to this proposal, and we'll be able to see how swaps and futures integrate and are going to transact. So I set that up with that caveat.
I think it was the right thing. I mean, I think we all, five of us, sort of are grappling. Core Principle 9 has changed.
Yep.
Congress did change the language about insuring for the price discovery on the centralized market. We put a proposal out. We got a lot of comments, as you say, but the intersection, you listed three things. I listed a fourth thing, also the intersection to me with direct open access to clearing. I think we'll benefit from another, whether it's another month or two, or as Commissioner Wiegin said, months, I don't know, but however it is, until we get to that central.
And now you're getting into my question, though, so let me ask it. So what is going to happen, though, with regard to implementation of, and this is for the team, this goes into effect 60 days after this hits the Federal Register, and as we work through the integration and discussion, what will DCMs have to do to comply with Core Principle 9 in the meantime?
So the core principles have been effective since the Dodd-Frank Act was took effect, which was last June. And so the DCMs today are currently complying with each of the core principles, but use their reasonable discretion in determining the method in doing that. We anticipate that DCMs would continue to do that for Core Principle 9 in the way that they've complied over the past, 11 months, until final rules are adopted.
Terrific. Thank you. We asked the Core Principle 3. I think Commissioner Summers took care of Core Principle 21, which I think is greater flexibility is a great solution there to facilitate competition in this space. Core Principle 4, I mentioned in my opening remarks, you have changed it to be, again, this is another area where it's more flexible than the original proposal. Can you kind of explain how you, what accommodations you've made to this core principle and your expectations for it?
Sure. So in the NPRM, Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, we posed questions to market participants as to what types of risk controls were appropriate. And based on the comments that we received, we determined that, and based on the tax subcommittee report, we determined that there was some level of standardization that was important, particularly in extreme market disruptions. The rule requires that designated contract markets must implement risk controls as appropriate to ensure that there aren't disruptions in the underlying in their markets. And those risk controls must include or but not be limited to trade pauses and halts. What we've done is essentially then also included acceptable practices, which have a non-exhaustive list of enumerated trade risk controls that DCMs can implement depending on their particular markets, the products, the parameters of which they themselves would set and would submit to the commission, but essentially we would leave it in the DCM's court to be able to make those determinations. And that is sort of consistent with the tax subcommittee report findings and would also leave room there for any additional guidance or interpretation or rulemaking that the commission may in the future decide to put together in order to mandate additional risk controls if necessary.
Thank you very much. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Malia. Commissioner Wiegin.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. One of the, when Congress put together the Dodd-Frank Act, it had, well, I guess the first choice it had was to decide whether swaps should be executed on these platforms. And the answer to that was yes. And then the next question was, well, should we just use DCMs or is there some other way to go about this? And so in Dodd-Frank, there was created this new registration category for swap execution facilities. And I think the thinking behind it was that there would probably be more competition among execution platforms if this new registration category were created and all the attendant benefits that come with that. And so in recent days, I think all the commissioners have heard from a community of folks who might try and become SEFs at some point, and there have been some concerns about anti-competitive behavior of DCMs that could make it more difficult for SEFs to get off the ground. And in light of the purposes behind Dodd-Frank, I actually have some sensitivity to those concerns. And there are a variety of considerations that swap users are going to have to make related to both clearing and execution in terms of how they decide and where they decide to do these contracts. But focusing on what's in front of us today, the DCM rule, the one place where this issue could be addressed is in our core principle 19, the antitrust core principle. So I just wanted to ask the staff, you know, how would this work if there were a potential CEF out there or an existing CEF at some point in the future who suspected some type of illegal anti-competitive activity? What would be the process by which the commission would consider that? I presume it would be something that would have to be brought to our attention, brought to the commission's attention. But if that's the case, what would be the process after the commission were made aware of this?
Well, I think it may come to our well, let me just back up and say that we are aware of recent days' letters that were submitted to the commission, to the commissioners, and to us about potential problems with competition between existing DCMs and the CEFs. And we are cognizant of the concerns because it was the last couple of days. It's something that was not addressed, particularly in this rulemaking. We are recognize the concerns, and we fully intend to fully explore those concerns and work with all the commissioners and their offices as to delve into these concerns. It's fairly complicated issues that are raised, antitrust theory issues as well as some factual issues. So we can't really opine on the antitrust or other kind of legal basis for this. I can address how this may come to our attention outside of the letters that we've received, which may be a rule that one of the exchanges may promulgate and self-certify to us, saying that they are going to maybe bundle or cut fees, and that's something that we would then have an opportunity under our Part 40 to review. And we have a 10-day, but with the option, if it's complicated and novel, to turn it over to a 90-day review, and we take every opportunity to do that.
Well, I appreciate that answer, Nancy. And that's the answer I was looking for. I think the point I was trying to get across to the public and in part to the same people that you heard from was that we do have the tools available to us through this rule to respond to any kind of behavior like that, even if it wasn't specifically addressed in this rule in quite the way that they might have expected. So I appreciate that answer. Thank you. That's all I have.
Can I just follow up on Commissioner Wiegand's question? But I think that he's absolutely right that we have that opportunity. We used it once when, it was called ELX, right? Raised. It was under core principle at that point.
18 at the time.
What was it called?
18 at
18,
the time.
18, core principle 18, which was this. So there is an example, at least in my nearly 3 years here, one example where ELX raised, in essence, anti-competitive issues, and commission took
a lot of time,
and the commission staff took a lot of time addressing that. So that is an example of it. I think the bundling issues also relate to another provision of Dodd-Frank that Congress, to promote competition amongst trading venues, as Commissioner Wiegand noted, also provided that clearinghouses provide non-discriminatory open access to trading venues. So I think that's I would hope that during this period, whether it's a month, whether it's 3 months, but whatever time we take as we're considering core principle 9 and the CEF rules, that market participants continue to give us their best thoughts as to the intersection of non-discriminatory open access as well, that swap execution facilities really are not required by Congress to be vertically integrated with a clearinghouse, but have access on a non-discriminatory basis. And sometimes bundling to one person appears non-discriminatory, but to another person appears discriminatory, and that'd be helpful to understand.
Well, I appreciate your comment, Mr. Chairman. I think the importance here is that the Commission has historically shown a real responsiveness to these types of concerns, and you gave one example of an incident that took place before it came, but that should be reassuring to people as well.
If there are no further questions, Commissioner Chilton, no, this is helpful.
I'm wondering, I've been a little bit concerned about the APA and comments that we get past the comment period, and I just wonder, I don't have a firm opinion on this, but with regard to Core Principle 9, if we should open up the comment period for some length of time certain, I don't know what it would be, or if what staff or you, Mr. Chairman, think, but I'm just curious whether or not we should do that, because the comment period is closed on this. We're doing the rule.
But as Mr. Berkovich, you can come forward and let us know. You're going to get a mic question here. We've used our discretion to continue to take comments, post them on our website, post the meetings as well as the actual comments. But, Dan, do you want to address
Generally, the staff has been operating under a policy of accepting late comments, provided that it's not so late in the process that it would actually impede the ability of the commission to deliberate. So until very close up to the commission's consideration, the staff has been exercising its discretion generally to consider late comments.
And does that... I mean, you feel comfortable that we could do that in this circumstance? I mean,
the staff could continue to exercise that discretion, yes.
And can we direct them to continue to do that discretion?
Certainly.
So I'm following Commissioner Chilton's suggestion, and here in the public, I'm directing you all to continue to consider and post into the administrative record and onto our public website so everybody can see and there's transparency.
Yeah, that's good. My concern, thank you. My concern in general is we set these timelines that say we're going to accept comments until this date, and then we provided flexibility to staff to still look at things afterwards. Well, you've got a lobbyist or you're a big firm and you know how we operate, you can come in and talk to us, but the general public may not be aware that you can continue that and that we do have this discretion. So I'm fine going forward with, as the chairman suggested, but that's been my concern.
And to give a little bit more transparency, and I've yet to look at Commissioner O'Malley's list, but I will and give thoughts to it even before it goes on the website, hopefully. But our hope is, and I think, Nancy, you can give us feedback because the relevant folks, Bella and others, report into DMO, is to get to a version to put in front of commissioners either by the end of this month or early in June. I see Bella there. She might be wincing a little bit as to when you think you would be getting a CEF document in front of commissioners. But if that were in June, then we could possibly be taking it up and voting on it in July. Bella, is that, roughly possible, or is it probably later, or...
I think our goal is to have a draft at early June.
And then commissioners could start to give feedback and so forth. Yeah.
I have a question on the same subject.
Sure.
If we were to propose something or try to come up with something completely different than the 85% forced delisting that we put out in 2010, would we be able to just go final with that without soliciting comment?
I think Dan's going to come back up and best be able to answer that.
In terms of final from the what the commission could do in a final rule, variations from the proposed rule, the basic test is whether the final rule would be a logical outgrowth from the proposed rule. So it would depend on exactly what the final rule was, but as long as it was something that the public had an opportunity to comment on, and then the particular could be termed a logical outgrowth of what was proposed. So it could be different, but it would be a logical outgrowth.
Yeah, I mean, an example is the block area we reproposed. I mean, we've had a couple of others that weren't as... noted as the block rule, but we reproposed on straight-through processing, though, again, didn't get a lot of publicity. and other circumstances where it's been a logical outgrowth, and we've often been less prescriptive. I think, been advised that we can finalize in those circumstances.
So Dan, if we went, just hypothetically, if we went 1% or we went 100%, would those be logical outgrowths?
I think it's difficult to, I wouldn't want to give a definitive answer right here and now, but the fact
theoretically, it could potentially be a logical outgrowth.
If it's
two caveat words there, theoretically.
Yes. Okay. I would agree with that, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, again, we delayed Core Principle 9 not because of it. It was a bandwidth problem. We could have voted yes or no on Core Principle 9, and we would have had, at least in my opinion, a different outcome. But I think we were searching for the right answer on execution. So I do hope, and this is an appeal to the public, so long as we have the opportunity, and you've instructed staff to talk about this, you know, putting this in a box, the four corners of what is a clearing, the trading mandate going to be, the issue of straight-through processing and clearing that you mentioned, and the execution on DCMs versus CEFs, all of that comes into play, and how, you know, we need input from the public on how that will impact trading in this market, the new, larger Dodd-Frank regulated market. So I think if anybody's listening and watching, and I suspect a few are, think about it, provide comment. The door, window, whatever, is open, and that would be helpful. I would urge that we do a roundtable, because then you could sit down and have that, and it's open. Everybody would see that. It would be the public could see it, to Commissioner Chilton's point, and it wouldn't be a bunch of, you know, high-paid lobbyists and firms here that would have an input on this, but people could watch an open meeting and discussion about a roundtable. And I think that would be – then we could have all the points discussed and the trade-offs.
As you've observed over these last 18 or 24 months, I've been a big proponent of transparency and roundtables, and I think we're up to 16 or 17, and we're about to have another one in late May here I'm announcing something, sorry, Steve Adamski, but, you know, we're about to probably have one on the Volcker Rule, which I think would be very helpful, that working with other agencies we get input. I think there is some bandwidth issues just in terms of, but I leave it to staff to sort through that as to what's the best way to get input. Mr. Stawick.
Commissioner Wiegin.
Aye.
Commissioner Wiegin, aye. Commissioner O'Malley.
Aye.
Commissioner O'Malley, aye. Commissioner Chilton.
Aye.
Commissioner Chilton, aye. Commissioner Summers.
Aye.
Commissioner Summers, aye. Mr. Chairman.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, aye. On this question, the yeas are 5, the nays are 0.
Thank you, Mr. Stawick. Thank you to all the commissioners, the ayes being unanimous. We'll be sending it to the Federal Register. Do I need a unanimous consent on technical corrections?
Yes, sir.
So I ask for unanimous consent on also allowing for technical corrections without objection. I want to thank Nadia, Nancy, Rick, David, Rachel, and Mike, who sat at the table, but all of the many other people, probably dozens, who have worked on this. I think it is a very important role to help promote the transparency reforms of Dodd-Frank, but also to give clarity to these exchanges and contract markets on how to best comply, and where appropriate to ensure that they're not competing on risk mitigation and other things that futures commission merchants and market participants have sort of something consistent to work with. So I thank you. I know it's been a lot of work, and this is hundreds of detailed provisions, but I thank you all. If there's nothing else, I'll take a motion to adjourn the meeting.
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? We all are unanimous on the adjournment. Thank you.